May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. So a bunch of Jews go up on a mountain. Sounds like the start of a joke, right? But that's precisely what's going on here. A large number of Jewish people came to be taught, to be preached to by Jesus. I want you to imagine yourself being a part of that crowd. You've just heard Jesus preach on the Beatitudes, probably one of the most comforting teachings that has ever been taught to a people who have lived under oppression for generations. All that lovely language that could be given, the shorthand version of, you who are suffering will be the ones given grace and comfort and love. Those who've had the good life already, well, maybe not so much. You've also been given some instruction on how when all this good stuff starts to happen, you've got an obligation to spread the love, to be the salt flavoring the world, to be the light to others. So at this point, you're probably feeling pretty good about yourself and your prospects. I guess so. And then, as good preachers always do, there's a little bit of a turn. Jesus starts in with another teaching. Didn't he ever hear that folks start to wiggle after the preacher goes on for more than 11 minutes? But this teaching feels like a strange one. He has laid out his main teaching about all the blessings that are to come. And now he starts in on what is sometimes called the antitheses. Say that five times fast. Statements that say, you've heard it said, but. There's a temptation to interpret that word to mean that what precedes it is negated. And I'd suggest that it doesn't negate. Instead, it amplifies. It adds more depth and understanding and richness and challenge to it. Doesn't negate. Remember, after all, that Jesus says earlier in this chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill." So how does this play out? Let's look at a couple of these antitheses. You've heard it said that you shall not murder, but I say, if you're angry or insulting or mean-spirited, you have sinned. Go reconcile. You're going to be judged not only on avoiding murdering somebody, and most days even I can avoid murdering somebody, but on being loving and being kind and being grace-filled in our relationships with our fellow human beings. And there are days when that is very, very hard. Loving and kind and grace-filled. Think about that before you hit send on your next post on Facebook. I'm convicted. And I know it is hard. I like to watch Stephen Colbert. Do we have any Colbert fans in the house? I've given up watching the national news because it breaks my heart. But I'll watch satire based on the news. And Colbert is funny. And I can tolerate hearing about the latest awful piece of news because Colbert makes it funny. But lately, I found myself cringing a little bit because sometimes the line between satire and nasty is so very thin. I still laugh, but I'm cringing too. And I wonder how often I've said something that verges on the cruel to score a point. Said something demeaning. Sounds like I've got some work to do. Maybe we all do, because Jesus has just amped it up. He has amplified the bare law, don't kill anybody, with the deeper underlying principle of the law, which is always about relationship with each other and relationship with God. Let's tackle another one. You've heard it said that you should not commit adultery, but, and here I can imagine certain people in the crowd thinking, oh, I'm getting out of it, yay. But it's different. I say, if you're thinking those thoughts, even if you haven't done anything but think about them, you have sinned. So much for the adage, well, I know I can't eat that, but I can surely look at the menu. Darn. I know it's hard. We live in a highly sexualized culture, but when we sexualize our response to another human being, when we view them as body parts that we get to judge, when we objectify someone, that means we're not in relationship with them, as Jesus invites us to do. We don't look at a child of God, a bearer of God's image. We see a thing that is available for our own fantasies, obsessions, or use. Don't get me wrong, this is about not about a dogma of purity where we all cover ourselves to protect ourselves from one another's gaze, but it's the obligation that we all carry, the choice that we must make to look upon others, first and foremost, as fellow children of God. A story. When my daughter was a tween, she got dinged by the authorities at her middle school for wearing a top that did not have the requisite 3-inch wide straps. The top had been washed and dried, and now the straps were a mere 2 3/4 inches wide. And she was going to be suspended for a day. So we protested it to the vice principal. He said, well, we're protecting the girls with this because provocative dress can inflame the boys. You know how boys are. And Doug, God bless him, said, why is all the onus on the girls? Why aren't you teaching the boys to restrain that so-called inflammation? And you know, there's no good response to that. And she was still suspended for a day. But this is precisely what Jesus was talking about here. Adultery at its heart is a fundamental lack of respect for another. Relationship is not about using another. And purity laws aren't about relationship with one another. But Jesus sure is. He is amping it up. So here's the sticky one, the one that makes each of us who has divorced and remarried get a cold chill up our spine. It was also said that whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife causes her to commit adultery. Damn, I'm in trouble. On the face of it, this seems to be Jesus amping up the sinfulness of divorce, but it is not as simple as it seems. In a way, Jesus is saying that the man has all the control in this situation, because in those days, only the man got to ask for a divorce, and actually the man always got the divorce. Maybe it's because his wife turned out to be infertile, a common reason in the ancient world. Or maybe he's bored with her, nothing new under the sun. or because she doesn't make the chickpea stew the same way his mother did. The man doesn't have to have a good reason. Now Jesus, because he is a person of his time, gives the guys a buy on unfaithful wives for some rather complicated reasons tying to genealogy and property ownership. I kid you not. But then he says, you're unilaterally breaking a covenant of relationship, and she has no say in this. Because of the way our culture works, either her family has to take her back, or she finds somebody else to marry her and care for her, or worst case scenario, she supports herself as a prostitute. The divorcing husband always gets the kids, always, because they're chattel property, just like the wife is. But Jesus says that's not the way marriage is supposed to be. It's two humans in a relationship. Two humans. And one human does not have the right to unilaterally toss the other human out the door. Jesus amps up the responsibilities in marital relationships because you don't throw out the door another child of God that you've made promises to as if no promises had ever been made. Yes, sometimes that is the sad conclusion of relationships, but it must be a conversation of equals, not somebody throwing out the trash. Relationships are precious. Both parties are equal in them. We might consider that Jesus was, in a way, an early feminist. He was certainly bucking the culture because he understood that our Creator made us all, whatever gender expression we are, to be in relationship with Creator God so that relationships between all God's created ones would be equal ones. Hard stuff. Jesus keeps amping it up, making our choices less simple than just checking a box of something that's relatively easy to avoid. The New Testament scholar Eric Barrett says it best, in the end, to what are these commandments calling us? Not to a checklist of morality, but to a flourishing of life. Not to a baseline of decency, but to an embodied, relational, transformational encounter with all whom we meet. Not to a sufficient set of hurdles for righteousness, but to a path of wholeness with creature and creator alike. Jesus amps it up and challenges us in the choices that we make to amp it up as well. Not law for law's sake, but to make choices that mark us as those made a little lower than the angels. It's a high bar indeed. Can we amp up our own understanding of what it means to be a child of God, striving for righteousness, for love, for grace, for all we were created for? In this season of division and anger, it may be our best hope. Amen.